This morning, our Dharma talk will be given by senior Dharma teacher Steve Wallace, who also happens to be the Shuso, or head student, for this retreat.
Thank you, Melissa. It's so wonderful to have all of you here on this Ongo practice period of intensifying our Zen practice for this period of 3 weeks. These things have come to mean so much to me and my Zen practice, and I am really clear that this is something that I could not do on my own, that it's something that Sangha has to do together, because I can't do it. I just would not be able to keep sitting and sitting without your support. So on this Ongo, we're talking about koans and perhaps favorite koans, and I was a bit stumped by that because I'm not sure I exactly have a favorite koan, but I picked one out for this morning that is particularly meaningful for me, because I think it illustrates perfectly the exact predicament that that I find myself in personally. I often feel exactly like the main character in this little story, and perhaps you'll see why. So this is case 5, Xiangyan up tree. The priest Xiangyan said, "It is though you were up in a tree, hanging from a branch with your teeth. Your hands and feet can't touch any branch. Someone appears beneath the tree and asks, 'What is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West?' If you do not answer, you evade your responsibility. If you do answer, you lose your life. What do you do?" Wu Men's comment: "Even if your eloquence flows like a river, it is all in vain. Even if you can expound cogently upon the whole body of Buddhist literature, that too is useless. If you can respond to this dilemma properly, you give life to those who have been dead and kill those who have been alive. If you can't respond, you must wait and ask Maitreya about it." Wu Men's verse: "Xiangyan is just babbling nonsense. His poisonous intentions are limitless. He stops up the monks' mouths, making his whole body a demon eye." So it's though you were hanging by your mouth from the branch of a tree and unable to reach any branch for some reason. That isn't exactly clear. But I really feel like this a lot of the time, you know, like I am just barely managing to hang on, you know, and it's kind of funny because I have a problem with TMJ, and after much research, it turns out that I don't actually grind my teeth at night. What I apparently do is clench my jaw during the day. So I'm exactly in this situation where I am constantly clenching my jaw like this, holding on for dear life. And I think what makes it even more painful than finding myself in this situation, in my real life situation with the TMJ, is that I'm supposed to be a good Zen student and pay attention to what's going on, and particularly with what's going on in my body. And you would think that realizing that I'm doing this jaw-clenching activity that I would be able to notice that going on. And throughout the day, I do actually notice that that's going on, and I stretch my jaw muscles a little bit and relax, and I'm okay for a while. And then I get distracted by the world, and sometime later I realize, Steve, you have your jaw all clenched up again. What, you know, why don't you just stop doing this? Why don't you just notice that you're clenching your jaw and stop? You know, you should be more aware of this. And I blame myself for lacking the awareness to do something about this. It's making my jaw deteriorate. You know, and I should just be able to bring some mindfulness to it. It's quite an anguish to realize that for whatever reason I keep doing this to myself, and here I am up this tree, and I'm hanging onto a branch by my teeth, and some clown wanders by and thinks that it's a good idea to ask me what is the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West as I'm hanging from this tree. And so I'm really, as I was looking at this koan, I'm trying to get inside the head of this character who wanders by and sees me up this tree and asks me this ridiculous question about the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West. What is going on here? And so my initial take on it was that that this person must be a Zen student or something, and that they are in so much pain themselves that seeing me hanging from a tree, they think, I bet this guy knows an answer that is going to solve my problem. And I am in so much pain that I just have to know, you know, what's the meaning of life, you know? Please just tell me, and I'll go away. I won't bother you anymore. So that's one possibility, that the questioner is in so much pain themselves, that is so vivid for them that there's really nothing else that they can see but their own suffering, and not a thought for anyone else. Just please help me. What is the meaning? So I really like that idea of what's going on here. But then later I had another thought about what might be going on here. And that is that perhaps this is a Zen teacher wandering through and finding me in this predicament. Or actually seeing that I am in this predicament of clenching and holding on and saying, Steve, why don't you get up front and give a talk? Tell us about how things are for you. Maybe that'll explain the meaning of Bodhidharma's coming from the West for everyone. So here I am, clenching my jaw and having so much anxiety and sitting here trying to convey some meaning that is important to me. And I don't know. I often think, you know, well, what can I possibly say to people? I'm such a mess myself, you know, that I certainly hope no one would emulate me and find themselves then in my situation, because it's just so painful to be up this tree and hang from my teeth. And why don't you just go off and take a swim or a walk or something, and don't, you know, just leave me here. I think the The important thing, and the reason why perhaps Zen teachers stick me in this predicament is to help me see how important it is to actually examine what's going on here. Just to notice and to bring some awareness to this struggle of being a human being and trying to make our way through the world as best we can through all the situations and difficulties that come up. And it's just so real for me. I'm an engineer, a software engineer, and my specialty is troubleshooting. When there's a problem, they say, "Oh, go get Steve, and he'll figure it out." You know, you go, "Steve, go look for what's wrong here." And I do. I latch onto the problem with my teeth, and I bite in, and I shake it around, and I hold on, and I chew it until either I find a solution or I get so exhausted I can't hang on anymore, one or the other. Both happen. And so here we are, you know, I'm up this tree, and eventually I'm going to let go. There's just no two ways about it. This is life, you know, it ends. We all get older and sicker and die in the end. And for me, I spend a lot of that lifetime hanging in a tree by my teeth. And it's just so poignant, you know, to really appreciate that experience. And when I say appreciate, I don't mean to be filled with gratitude for. I mean appreciate in the sense that a doctor might use it. If you've ever read a medical report, doctors often say, "So, I appreciated the wound. Which means that I examined it. I noted what is within the normal range, and I looked to see, you know, what is not, and I really paid attention here to what the problem is, and now maybe we can do something about it." So it's this sort of appreciation that I'm talking about. You know, it's not being filled with gratitude for my situation, but it's a willingness to actually look at it. You know, and I find that when I actually do sit and come here and look at some of the painful things that I tend to avoid during my ordinary struggles with life, I come here on these practice periods and have an opportunity to sit down and take a look at the very things that I have been trying to avoid. And what fun, you know, to see all these things that I would rather not see. And yet I come here and I look, you know, and I think it's of such tremendous value to take the time to actually see the situation that I'm in. Because it seems less painful just to ignore some of this stuff, but I think unless we actually take a look and appreciate what's going on, it's hard to have compassion for the situation, you know. And when you really look at it and you see, oh, that's really hard, you know, you actually have a lot of things going on here that are very difficult. Of course, you know, you're struggling, you know, and wow, I'm really appreciating that struggle and the spirit of meeting all this. And most of the time, I'm not aware of it, and that's fine too, I guess, you know. But I like to set aside these times to come here and examine and appreciate really experience what it's like to be alive, to be the universe, life, appreciating life in the form of me, of us, of ourselves. This is what it means to be human. This is what it means to be alive. This is what it means to be the universe. Without duality, we can't really appreciate, can we? It takes a subject and an object. I think that's enough.
So this is the time for our Dharma dialogue, so please take the tree out of your mouth and relax your posture.
Steve, I can tell you why the Zen teachers ask you to give your talk. Because there's always something so sort of pure and direct and unvarnished. I mean, I know you're very smart and very insightful, and you could say lots of things and you just cut right to the heart in a way that's, I think, hard for a lot of the rest of us, and capture something that's very deep and meaningful for everyone. So I really appreciate that, and I always greatly value it.
And Carolyn, what did it touch for you? So what did you see directly present?
You really want to hear?
Yes.
Your turn.
I wish it was as poignant. It's more the kind of humiliation of the difficulty of changing. As you were telling the story of your TMJ, lots of things were going through my mind about simple, stupid things that I try over and over to change. But the most recent one is my ongoing argument with my husband about closing the bathroom door because it lets cold air, but it's not very heated. And almost every time I come out, he says, "Why didn't you close the door?" And I say, "I don't know, I forgot." And I tell myself over again, It's been going on for months now, and I finally said, "I think I better put signs up to remind me." So I have one on the outside of the door, the inside of the door, the mirror, and they get funnier and funnier the closer I get into the door. But it's sort of mortifying, but even something like that is so hard to change. And I think it sort of puts me in touch with how the hard things, the easy things, we're set in our ways, and human beings are not easy things to work with. I wish it was as moving as yours, but it's the same in some ways, the same difficulty about being other than we are.
Yeah. And it's the same wishing to be otherwise that I hear from you too. And I get that a lot, you know, wishing that I was different. And this is so much not about that. You know, David was stressing how this is a non-doing practice, right? That it isn't about doing something about the realities. You know, if even if we solve the one problem, another will pop up. Right?
Exactly.
Right? So can we just be with the difficulty? And so, and I was thinking, not only is it a non-doing, but it's also a non-stopping, right? So it's not doing anything, but it's also not trying to stop what's going on. It's an appreciation of what's going on, really examining, well, what's going on here, and being curious about it, and not blaming ourselves for the fact that it's happening, but just noticing. And I think in that noticing, you know, something appears, like, oh, maybe I should put a note on.
And noticing how impossible it is to stop blaming.
It is very, very difficult. I think we can stop blaming, you know, for the situation, but it keeps coming up over and over again. You know, the self arises as blame, and we think we're in control. And, you know, why can't I do a better job of this? It's so simple seeming, you know. And we blame ourselves, and that's natural, but we just see the blame arising and say, ooh, self arising.
And you know that part of this that I loved what you said about appreciate. I loved everything about this talk. I just feel like I can retire now. This is, you said so beautifully what I've been trying to say for years and years and years. I'm just so grateful. But I think we have to give her
something. She's getting a little deep. She's in a little deep.
No, I know. It's just this moment. But this idea that we have to give ourselves permission to never, ever, ever remember about the bathroom door for the rest of your life, but to commit to appreciating. And the same thing, you'll blame, 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 but give yourself permission to blame for the rest of your life. That this is not about, this is not a self-improvement project. It really isn't. That would be, that's, there are many ways to do that, but you know, how many of us have, how many books do we have on our shelves? Right? This is not about that. This is a seeing the self in order to forget the self and to be awakened by all things. But it's not seeing the self, so I'm going to fix myself. Damn it. Yeah. And this is so subtle. I mean, that's why I appreciate the talk so much, because it's really hard to say it. You have to have lived it. You have to have had that thing in your mouth and you know, felt the pain in your jaw. And that's just one example.
In the gospel reading last Sunday, Jesus says near the end, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. And I recall that someone along the line had said that a better translation is be whole as your Father in heaven is whole. And having grown up struggling with perfectionism and of course never achieving it in any walk of life, I really think that that whole, the idea of being whole connects to somehow to what you're talking about, what you've been talking about all week, actually. But
yeah.
Somehow you're, yeah, you can be whole while still clenching your teeth occasionally. But I don't, you know, what that means takes work and a lot of time appreciating, I think.
So my wife is also a Zen practitioner. A lot of you know her, Laura. And we have kind of this running joke about things being perfect, whether we're talking about really perfect or we're talking about Zen perfect, which is perfect just as it is, right? So we have this idea of what perfect means, you know, that it's this perfect circle or you know, geometric thing, you know, of perfection. But that's an idea, you know. This perfection that we're talking about in Zen is not that at all. It's just being the way that it is. It's this suchness, this thusness, this just already perfect.
It's quite a joke you got there.
Zen jokes. You know, some of you know that I love word derivations, and the word whole comes from Anglo-Saxon roots, right? And it's the same root as healthy, hale. You know, that it's got that complete feeling. Mm-hmm. And perfect is a Latinate word, and it comes from perfectio. And per means through, and fectio means done. So it was originally used, I heard someone once told me to refer to bread when it's ready to come out of the oven. It's done through. All cooked, all set. You go boom, 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 boom. It's a beautiful sound. And so this is part of what I think the word perfect in modern English got screwed over. You know, it's like, and we whip ourselves with it, and we compare ourselves. But some original, you know, word derivations, you think the early humans who were trying to find words for things came up with this thing to be aligned with, to be in relationship with, to be fully, fully, fully cooked, fully baked. Yeah,
those of us who are alive in the 60s have a different meaning for fully baked.
60s, come to California.
No, thank you.
Well, and this is opposed to half-baked.
Right, it's whole.
There is a wonderful insult in Zen, you half-baked fellow. half-baked
fellow. Now we know that to compliment.
Yeah. That's right.
You're halfway there.
Yeah. And halfway, as we learned the other day, is all the way there.
So, Steve, I appreciated the fact, excuse me, that you had the compassion to see the other person in that particular koan. And not only that, but that you ascribe these benevolent motivations for them, that, you know, the Zen teacher trying to help, and the student who truly wanted to know, because, you know, frankly, as I was sitting there listening to you say that, what hit me was, and this probably says much more about me, I was thinking, why, maybe he's just a jerk. They're going, I'll meet him, this guy. Let's watch him fall. And then as I was thinking that, it hit me that, you know, perhaps a jerk is just someone who's in such pain,
right,
that he doesn't and doesn't know it. And it's a little bit like your description of walking around clenching your jaw and forgetting that you're doing that, and then remembering, and perhaps he'll remember someday.
Mm-hmm. Well, we see his predicament.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then also, wherever that one is coming from, he's giving a gift, right? The whole story comes from that poke. And whatever that person, whether they thought they were being benevolent or didn't care or were in pain or just whatever, the gift that awakens, that breaks the cart,
yeah,
you know, is that poke.
Well, that's like that story or suggestion that you came up with, or that you related a couple days ago about, you know, maybe we should all go through an entire day, mm-hmm, pretending that, or imagining that, no matter what someone says to us, no matter who they are, you know, the cop who pulls you over, the postman, whatever, that they're there to say exactly what you need.
Right. Right. Yeah.
They're bodhisattvas.
Yeah.
We don't even have to imagine or pretend. And somebody once told me that one definition of sangha is a group of people who bother each other. You know, and we can be great.
Yeah.
Thanks. Thank you.
And when you said that you didn't want anyone to emulate you, I just want you to know that there are lots of people who do want to emulate you, and there are
fools.
There are people who regularly listen to these teshos that Steve lovingly and generously, with his very limited time, posts to the internet for everyone who can't be right here and wishes they could be right here. And they have told me that of all the talks they listen to, you are the one who speaks most directly to their heart. Thank you.
Because we're all up a tree.
Mm. Right.
You know, you say, I'm up a tree, and our hearts resonate because each one of us is up the tree. And has no idea what to do, no way out, right? And to name it is some great gift, right?
Well, and I think it's really important to say that you could just share your heart with us and the pain and the suffering. And if it ended there, it wouldn't be so useful. But it's so clear, and this is so important, that this is not just a teaching of despair and being of the truth. Yeah. This is about learning to live the life we have as it is. We don't get another life. This is it. This is the only life there is right now. Whatever you might speculate about, but this is all we know right now. This is it. So how do you live that fully? And that's what you took us to in the talk. If you had stopped halfway through, we would have all been left up the tree. And instead, we're all in the forest with you, like a bunch of people hanging off trees together. And
where are you going for?
When Jesus was on the cross, and he says to the, I'm not an expert on this, but he says to somebody nearby, you will be with me in heaven. And there's a Zen teacher, I think it was Soen Roshi, who heard that story and said, either Jesus isn't enlightened, or it was mistranslated. Mm-hmm. And he found a Greek translation that said, you are with me in heaven. Oh. Which totally cuts through the... It's very much like this. Mm-hmm. And that's the edge, right? That someday there'll be pie in the sky. But no, this suffering, this is the full life.
And that Jesus, there was love in what he said to that.
The thieves, right?
They were thieves.
Yeah, real love, real connection, real, we're in this together. I might be the son of God, but you're a thief. But no, suddenly that all disappears.
Yeah, the common humanity. Yeah.
Luckily, I did stop halfway through, and I was going to use the story that Aiken talks about that's very similar, where you're chased off a cliff by a tiger, and there's another tiger below at the bottom of the cliff, and there you are hanging by this vine that's being eaten away by two mice. And you know that you're going to fall. And you see this strawberry on the side of the cliff, and you reach out and pick the strawberry and eat it, and it tastes so sweet.
And you fall.
And then you fall.
Well, who knows?
Well, there's no other way out. There's a tiger above and a tiger below, and you're hanging there. This is your life, hanging.
You could give it to the mice.
Right, we're always trying to bargain. If I do this and do that, can I get out of this?
I get into this. Then I'll stop nibbling. Yeah. And I'll be able to be there forever.
But this, and right at the end, this subject and object, this duality, this unworkable life, is the blessing that allows us to perceive. You know, without this terrible separation that eats at our heart, that we so are convinced of our separateness or our inadequacy, without that subject-object, without incarnating, we don't get to appreciate. Right? That this, it seems like, why is life so unworkable? Why do we live and then we die? The whole thing is just to die? But it's much greater than that. But the possibility that this unworkability, this dukkha, is not the problem. Right? It's not what we have to fix in order to get somewhere else. Because as you said, you fix one thing and you just get the next.
It's the price of admission.
Yeah, and the Buddha never said it was a problem, to my understanding. He said it's one of the great marks of existence and the first noble truth, not the first problematic. Sucky truth.
And it's also a problematic sucky truth. Yes,
so you had your
hand. Oh, I was going to say I could identify you with you being hanging off that branch. But, and to me, it feels like I've let go completely. I mean, free fall, and there's a kind of freedom to that. because without it, I wouldn't be able to come practice the Dharma. And, you know, it's almost like that tree is my old self. I've completely let go of everything, like all my preconceived notions of life, of everything I can ever imagine. And, you know, that's the only way I could come and practice the Dharma. So I could completely identify with that.
It's lovely. Freedom to let go.
I don't know how it's going to end, though.
We don't know.
No, I mean, in terms of Dharma, yes, I will get to it. Before the end.
And this process of letting go, I mean, we all get to the point. And I think we only let go when we've run out of all our other options. We've tried bargaining with the mice. We've tried this. And sometimes those work temporarily. But at some point, we run out of options. And then we are let go of or something. There's this falling, this dying, whatever it is. And even that's not permanent.
Uh-huh.
Right? Even then there's the next letting go.
Yeah.
There's always this, and always the possibility at every moment to let be more deeply, or how there's this tendency to get stuck again and again.
Right.
Let go completely, and we can appreciate the falling and the freedom of dying. But then we're reborn. And then we get to do it over and over again in the next way, right? And that's not a problem that it doesn't fixate. That's just simply the way it is. So now I'm in the falling. I've totally let go. And then there's the story. Oh, I'm the one who has totally let go. And then we have to subtly defend that story. And then that story becomes the branch we're holding on to. So now I'm biting into, I'm the one who's let go. And we have to let go of the letting go.
Right.
Continually. Yeah, it's quite wonderful that way.
That's true.
Yeah.
What you were saying, David, and also Steve, your talk reminds me of how many opportunities there are for shame and blame in the practice of all of our forms here.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, after all these years, I still turn the wrong way, forget where the line should go. God forbid I'm in the front of the line. And I was here the other day, and I ended up in the front of the line, and I just was going the wrong direction. Someone kindly from behind gently sort of repointed me. But then I carried that afterwards, you know, and I thought, she must have thought I was so stupid. How could I still be doing this, you know? And then in the days following, it would come up, and, you know, I would say to myself, oh, I'm so stupid. Out of nowhere, this thing would come up. But, you know, I finally did realize that this was something important to practice with.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that between whenever it was, a few days ago and now, I finally did actually let go of it and realize, whatever, you know, just whatever. But there's, to me, there's a certain irony about the seeming perfection of our, you know, united forms. We all do it a certain way. If we remember, if we pay attention, or we would, you know. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's really funny, too, in connection with what David was saying to Eva about this continual rebirth in the falling, you know, so you keep dying to the self. We keep changing the rules. You know, because we say, oh, this would be better. And then we do it, and then people go crazy. Because it's like, well, and so there's something wonderful about that. And if you go to any other Zen center anywhere else, it's different. You know, there the commonality is there is a way to do it, even within Boundless Way. There's differences. There's a way to do it, and you keep rubbing up against
this part of us, just like what Lynn brought in, that really wants to do it right. And then, of course, shame comes up for all of us. All of us. Us too. All of us. All the time. Oh, you know, it's the Homer Simpson response. Yeah.
I was so glad when you dropped some food on the table the other day.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then when Carolyn did it, not that I'm keeping track. I thought, well, hopefully Carolyn feels better about it having seen that you made it sit down.
Carolyn's just trying to be like me.
No, and then I thought, well, maybe you do that periodically just to show us that we can't be, you don't have to be.
Well, what I'm hoping is that everyone will finally drop food on the table as a perfect presentation.
So that you can just clean it up and go on. You know.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and I dropped it and then... You ran and got the sponge. It's like, oh, so it's a song.
It's a dance.
It's a little dance. Yeah, it's a little dance.
Mm-hmm. But I want you to hear, I was grateful for that.
Yeah. Well, if I tried to do it, it wouldn't be as nice. Right.
In our meeting, whose turn is it to drop food?
Oh, yeah. To pretend.
Right, to pretend. To go to sleep during sitting.
I'll pretend.
The snoring.
and Laura, what I get too, and what you're saying is the transformation point is from problem to practice. So right, this arises, and we think, well, I shouldn't feel it, or I shouldn't do it, and it feels like just in holding that, you saw, oh, this is practice. Right.
Yeah, right. So that's what you were kind of talking about. That happens over and over.
Yeah.
You know, and it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know.
Don't. You went like this, you know. But then it's like, why am I even doing this practice? You know. I mean, so it's that, you know, that irony and the learning that comes with it, the little awakening that happens.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West?
Pardon me.
Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? You know, why? Yeah. Well, I think that's a good place to end.